Hello, and welcome to a special bonus edition of the Sober Curious podcast. I'm your host, Ruby Warrington, and regular listeners will be aware that the show is currently on a bit of a hiatus while I focus on launching my new book, Women Without Kids, which is out March 28th in the US and April 13th in the UK. I've also been airing a limited Women Without Kids podcast series, which I created from research interviews I conducted for the book. And as I was getting the latest episode ready to air, it struck me that the subject matter is absolutely relevant for anybody who's examining their relationship to alcohol and or other addictive substances and behaviors. So I decided to share it here too. My guest is therapist and author Kelly McDaniel, whose latest book, Mother Hunger, examines the impact on women specifically of having lacked the proper nurturance, protection, and guidance from their primary maternal figure in early life. As you will hear, it's estimated that up to 50% of the population, men and women, experience some degree of mother hunger. We get into the reasons for this, and Kelly explains why mother hunger often finds us seeking mother substitutes to fill the empty feeling we carry with us inside, in the form of food, love, sex, alcohol, and other drugs. I hope you enjoy this conversation. For me, it sheds so much light on the root causes of the addiction issues we face as a society, which is something I discuss in my new book. Oh, and fans of the Sober Curious podcast, I will be coming back with a new season later in the year. For now, thanks for listening. This is Kelly McDaniel. Kelly, thank you so much for joining me. When we first connected, I shared with you that for me, the term mother hunger has had the same sort of impact in the culture as a term like sober curious. In that, I think you've come up with a term that describes something that a lot of people have been experiencing or are currently experiencing, but didn't necessarily have language for. And you came up with this two-word, very simple-seeming term that I think just very immediately sums up this feeling of mother hunger. So for people who haven't connected deeply with your work, and I'm sure you've been asked this before, I've been asked 1,000 times the same question about Sober Curious, but I think it will be helpful just for listeners to hear a bit about, in your own words, how you came up with that term and your definition of mother hunger.
Thank you, Ruby, for having me. And yes, I'd be happy to do that. And even before I do that, I love the way you said this seemingly simple term. It does seem seemingly simple, the word mother, the word hunger. And yet, when you hear the word for the first time, let's say, what is the experience you had in your body? Do you remember what it felt like to hear the word?
It felt validating. It felt like I wanted to investigate. It felt like here is a doorway for me to walk through to investigate something that has been central to my life and that I experience, or that I believe is central to many people's lives. It felt like an invitation and a doorway to walk through.
An invitation and a doorway to walk through. Mm. And it sounded like you were instantly curious.
Curious, yeah.
Okay. That's just a great place to start, because my experience is that when someone hears the term mother hunger, if they have mother hunger in some form, and there are different degrees, there's almost, you can almost hear it, there's a thud in the room, which I think is our body's way of settling down, like, oh, suddenly our body knows there's a name for what I've been carrying. I've been carrying around this invisible heartbreak. I've been carrying it, and it's been making me feel really badly. And then there's recognition. Aha. So I think when our body finds or hears a term that they've been looking for, and I say they because all the parts of our body, right? The younger parts of our body, the older parts of our body have been looking for what's wrong. We hear this term and suddenly we feel seen somehow. And we want to know more. So I love your experience. I think it sums up a lot of what women experience when they hear the term mother hunger for the first time, if they have mother hunger. And the science tells us that about 50% of the population has an insecure attachment style, that's all very different based on, are we more anxiously attached? Are we more avoidantly attached? But if we're anywhere on that spectrum, the word mother hunger is really going to soothe our nervous system right away. Because what it is it's a name for an invisible heartbreak, a heartbreak that happened generally before we had language. So there's been no way to identify it, talk about it. And then even if we got a little bit older and started to have a sneaking suspicion that there was something in the dynamic or lack of dynamic with our mother that wasn't feeling good, who could we tell? I mean, it's almost taboo to have those discussions. So there's something intrinsic to mother hunger that's also invisible. And I call it, well, part of mother hunger is betrayal blindness. And we can go into that later on if it comes up. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if I'm answering the question.
You are. And it's just making me think this sense of something being missing. I think the word that's why the word hunger is so powerful, because it mm-hmm. describes an emptiness and a something yes. missing. And in my case, an indefinable something missing, because on the surface, my mother is extremely nurturing, loving, attentive. And I could never describe or understand why I wasn't able to feel like I was really receiving that. And that's mm-hmm. something she and I have been able to discuss very openly mm. and very painfully as a result of me bringing some of this into my manuscript with Women mm. Without Kids. And it has actually started to fill the hole of the mother hunger in my life. And in fact, I think in both of our lives. I'll get into that a little bit more about my personal experience with it in a moment. But I'm very curious how mother hunger manifests. You said that about 50% of the population have insecure attachment. And there's a lot of language and a lot of conversation around attachment theory kind of in the public domain now, which again, I think speaks to people's curiosity about, oh, I can relate to this. Oh, yes, tell me more.
Yes, exactly.
So how, in terms of your clients and just sort of your research around this subject, what are some of the ways that mother hunger manifests in people's lives?
Yes, that's what I needed to come back to. How did I come upon this term?
Right.
I stumbled upon it. I, early in my practice as a younger clinician, I was training and learning to work with love addiction. And most of the literature out there that was talking to us about love addiction was really focused on men, written by men, focused on men. Pia Melody was the one person out there that was writing in a more gender-neutral kind of way. But even in her book and in every book out there, there was missing this cultural piece. Like, all the reasons for love addiction were being tied back to family of origin. And yes, that's a big piece. That's where mother hunger begins. But mother hunger doesn't happen in a vacuum. Love addiction doesn't happen in a vacuum. We live in a culture that is grooming us as women to think that love, specifically romantic love, is the answer to everything in our life. It's what we should aspire to. It's what we're made for. Disney has built a whole complete business around fairy tales. Originally, scary and gruesome, and they have become so beautiful and enticing. And so I needed to weave in this cultural piece that grooms women to become sex objects, to search for love as a way to understand love addiction. So I was writing that book, and then that book brought women into my practice, and over and over and over again, deeper in the healing, I would find two things. Issues with food were mixed up with issues with love. And both took someone to this primitive cry, I want my mom. Like when we would get to the core of some deep work, this is not beginning therapy one-on-one. This is deeper work where we're getting into some younger parts of the self. And over, that's what I would hear. I want my mom. And it was a craving, almost as primitive as our need to breathe, our need to eat. This was not an elective desire. This didn't mean someone was overly needy. It didn't mean that there was anything pathological going on. it was an unmet need for something as essential as water, which is our mother's nurturing, our mother's protection early in life.
And the third piece is mother's guidance.
The mother's guidance is the third piece. Yeah, it comes later. Like, we don't necessarily identify that we need her guidance till later. The first two, the nurturing and the protection, are very primitive pieces that are wired into our little body. If we're not fed on time, if we're let cry to sleep, that's going to threaten those basic needs to be safe and to be fed. Now, as we get older, we need a need for guidance. We want to admire her. We want her to inspire us. But if she has not herself been able to develop her own dreams, her own aspirations, her own talents, maybe she's not even living anymore. Maybe she is struggling with mental illness or addiction. We don't have a guide in our mother. We have to find other guides. And that is a significant form of mother hunger. It just comes along later.
That makes sense. That makes sense. So one thing I do want to kind of just interject with here, as we go on to talk about this and people are listening, they're possibly, it's bringing stuff up. They're able to reflect on their own experience with their mothers. This is, you know, part of the point of having this conversation and you doing this work. Mother hunger is not usually the result of any sort of sadistic or vindictive withholding of love on the part of our mothers.
That's third degree mother hunger. That's a different chapter.
Right, exactly. And this might be the result of having a narcissistic mother or
cruel mother.
A cruel mother, right. But this is not the majority of people who are experiencing mother hunger. It's nobody's quote unquote fault. Or is it? What's your take on that?
I think that mother hunger can emerge from having a well-meaning, loving mother, because this is an epigenetic inheritance. Mothers can only give their daughters or their sons what they received from their mothers, who then go back to their mothers. There's no manual on how to be a mother. The manual is how we were mothered. And for decades, the misguidance that well-meaning mothers have received about how to love their children, starting back in the 1920s with John Watson saying, don't touch your children, don't hug them too much. If they do something really great, pat them on the head. Definitely let them cry themselves to sleep. This kind of damaging parental misguidance has influenced the works of Dr. Spock, Baby Wise. I mean, there are still people out there advocating for sleep training. And all I can say is sleep training works if you're trying to train a dog. It works if you're training an animal. And it will work with a baby, because the baby will shut down their needs to attach to you. And then later in life, when you want them to attach to you and they can't, well, that's where the damage is more evident. Mothers don't see it when their little ones are little and the pediatrician is saying, oh, they're fine. Let them cry it out. That is damaging misguidance for attachment. So to back up a bit, as little newborns, we are born anticipating, wired for, built for our mother's embrace. We are designed to be fed on demand. That's why we're supposed to be held in her arms near her breasts, where there's milk and we can smell it and we don't have to go too long without being fed. Our world is just not set up for mothers and babies to bond this way. It's a radical act for a mother to carve out the capacity to nurture this way and keep her little one safe and reject the medical information that would say it's not necessary. And again, science and medicine are not informed by attachment theory. Not yet. We're way ahead of them. And I don't know when they're going to catch up. But in the meantime, clinicians that are interested in attachment, and myself with this book, are trying to really shift a paradigm that would say, if you're going to have this infant, here's what's going to be required. Because I think a lot of us don't know.
I think you're absolutely right. And this sort of leads into why I wanted to have you on this Women Without Kids podcast. I think it's probably a line in the book, but it's something that's sort of reverberated around my head for the duration of working on the manuscript and doing my research on this subject, is that the way we are mothered cannot help but inform how we feel about becoming mothers ourselves, whether it is then something that is that mothering style that we've inherited is then our sort of fallback and go-to when we become mothers ourselves, sort of on an unconscious level, or mm-hmm. whether it factors in a conscious or unconscious way to our own decisions about whether or not to have children. And so I'm wondering if that's something you've seen in your practice, whether, especially given that over the past 40 years, and particularly now as we kind of move into the 21st century, women are increasingly allowed to choose to opt out of motherhood, or at least to question whether they want to become mothers, which was not available to my mother's generation, for mm-hmm. example.
Right.
And I'm wondering how you think mother hunger is impacting our procreative choices going forward.
Mm-hmm. Such a great question. And it's why I'm so glad you've connected the possibility that choosing not to have a child could have something to do with mother hunger. There are lots of reasons to choose not to have a child. And there are lots of reasons that it's not even a possibility. Messing with women's fertility, for example, can have long-term consequences. So I don't want to suggest that mother hunger is the only reason, although I think it's a big one. I think, yes, if we were raised by a mother who, let's say, we wanted more of her, we felt deprived, we were hungry all the time, we might unconsciously think we can fill that void by having children. We'll get the love we didn't get from her through our own children. So I see that a lot, and the legacy of that is really unfortunate. I also see the flip side, where daughters who were somehow put in a position to make their mother happy, put in a position to take care of their mother too young, or take care of their younger siblings too young because their mother was just unable to do it. In other words, I've worked with adult daughters who chose not to have children because they felt burned out somehow. This wasn't necessarily conscious. It wasn't always a choice they made. It was more like an aversion, like, ugh, I don't have this motherly instinct. And I think it's not that the instinct was so much just gone as much as it was used up, if that makes sense. If you have a needy mom and you're her firstborn daughter, let's say, or you're her closest daughter, let's say, it's very likely that you were doing the mothering in the household. And that can create kind of an allergic reaction to the idea of having a child.
Oh, this is just fascinating. I'm sort of nodding along. There are elements of my story I can relate to in both scenarios that you're describing. I think on our first call, I was kind of asking you the question, you're just musing on whether or not I could have inherited my mother's mother hunger. My mother lost her mother when she was 18, but she was actually put into boarding school at age 11. So she didn't receive hands-on mothering from the age of 11. And even prior to that, her father was in the Air Force. They were constantly moving. She was in 7 different homes before the age of 11. And so had a very disordered sort of caregiving scenario, I think. Okay. And I think I also shared with you, so this is something you were reflecting on, how something you hear among clients when you get really deep into your work around this mother hunger is this just deep yearning, I want my mom.
Yeah.
I've never felt that. And that I think is the thing I feel the most, I've felt the most shameful of. And that shame has converted to deep sadness for never even wanting my mother, you know? My mom has shared with me that I began sucking my thumb, self-soothing, in utero.
Yeah.
That when I was an infant, as much as she wanted to hold me, she wanted to nurture me, I would push her away. I didn't want to be held. I didn't want to be picked up. I very rarely cried. Yeah. And reflecting on that, it seems like I shut down my need for mothering before I even had a chance to receive it. And that gap that I was describing before, this sort of distance between my mother and I, was as much about my inability to receive her mothering as her inability to give it. And so where you're describing, you know, this this idea of a woman who, one iteration of a woman of a mother hunger might be having a child to fulfill your own mother hunger, I don't know, I can sort of see elements of that in my own story, I think. And I'm curious to hear your reflections on that as well.
Thank you so much for sharing that. There's so much I want to say. And one I would like to start with is that the feeling of shame you talked about. I've seen this with so many adult daughters who really say to me, I never wanted my mother. They might have been embarrassed of her. They might have been disgusted by her. They may have just, she wasn't on their radar. And that legacy has its own unique pain because it's almost, it's so unspoken that how do I admit I don't want anything to do with my mother? And I never really did. So I've seen that shame time and time again. And I think it's a unique form of pain because there's a lot of loneliness with it. Where do you go to talk about that? And it can feel like, what's wrong with me that I didn't want my mother? So to then go back to what was very likely going on as you were marinating in the womb, in the uterine environment, is what we do is we're ingesting through amniotic fluid, through sounds, through mood, we're ingesting our mother's belief about herself and her pregnancy. So I always like to ask a woman when we're in session, and I'm not necessarily putting you on the spot here, although I always say, what was your mom feeling when she conceived and found out she was pregnant with you? How did she feel during her pregnancy? And the first reaction is always, well, how would I know that? I don't know. So we just sit and we wait. And the story always comes because it's in our body. Was she afraid? Was she hopeful? Was she dissociated? Did she even know she was pregnant? You know, there are women that didn't feel or register their pregnancy until it was so far advanced that there was just nothing there. And our grandmother's belief about pregnancy can also be part of our environment in utero as we're forming. So there's a lot going on in there that can that would have taught you on some level, I think I'm going to be better off sucking my own thumb and coming out pretty much managing my own needs right off the bat.
Right. I will need to be self-sufficient on some degree before I even take my first breath. Yes.
Yes.
And I think the shame that I described, there's been a huge guilt that I felt about not being the daughter that my mother wanted. She wanted nothing more than a loving relationship with her children. And my seeming inability to give that to her is something I have felt incredibly guilty about. And I can't help but feel that that factored into my own feelings about having a child. But where you describe, it's almost like my mothering capacity had been used up. I almost used it up on myself from what you're describing. And that resonates for me, absolutely. And I'm undoubtedly, I think some listeners will feel the same way. And it's so important to be able to recognize all the different factors that kind of play into these very unspoken or unspeakable and sort of ineffable feelings and sensations that we might experience in our relationships with our mother and in terms of how we feel about becoming mothers. I want to pivot to talking about the connection with food. I can't remember if this is a literal quote from the book or something I jotted down from our first conversation. And I mentioned already that I think the use of the word hunger is so, so powerful because it really does speak to this unnameable sense of emptiness. But then also very cleverly, it connects to the fact that food is a big part of our story about. So the quote that I have, our relationship to food tells a story about our relationship with our mother and about our attachment style. And this is, so I want to give a little bit of context here about why I want to speak to you about this piece specifically. It's such a big part of your book, obviously. And I almost pitched a book several years ago about just disordered eating, because it seems to me that so many women to some degree have experienced a conflicted relationship with food, whether that manifests a full-blown eating disorder or not. So I've touched in my first two books on the fact that I was anorexic from age 16 to 22. This coincided with a period of time when I was in my first long-term romantic relationship. And I had always put it down to that, honestly. It was not a great relationship. It was full of coercive control, very emotionally manipulative, sexually degrading. It was not a great introduction into the world of relationships or to my own kind of experience of my sexuality, honestly. Mm-hmm. And I had sort of read my developing anorexia during that period as a reaction to that and a way mm-hmm. of almost escaping from my body mm-hmm. in what was a very traumatic experience physically. And I wrote about this in the original manuscript, Women Without Kids. And in the end, I removed it because it just felt like it was too much to include, because I realized there was actually so much more to unpack around having been anorexic and my relationship to mothering. So one of the reasons I wanted to have you on was to kind of talk about that here, so we could kind of at least go into it. Because what I realized on reflection, and it's funny, isn't it, how the dots don't join up sometimes until decades later, but me getting into that relationship coincided with me leaving my mother's home to go and live with my father at the exact same time that his then girlfriend moved in with him and sort of assumed the role of like stepmother in my life. And I now, looking back, can't help but think that my rejection of food at that point in my life was a rejection of her influence in terms of mothering, given that I was already rejecting my biological mother by moving out of her home and saying, no, I don't want to be here anymore, which feels very revealing and very kind of vulnerable to share. But I kind of want to talk about it because I shared with you when we first spoke that to me, and this is a bit of an unformed thought, but I hope you can, you have some insights, or I'm sure you will. It seems to me that being a reproductive, which is a term, I don't know if that's a common term, but I sort of have started using it, meaning having no desire to have a child, no desire to reproduce, almost feels like a sort of anorexic response to mother hunger, in the same way that more avoidant attachment person might just deny the need for nurturing and protection, just shut it down as a self-protective mechanism. Totally denying the desire to have a child or be a mother or even have family is a way of shutting down that need that feels almost too out of reach or too painful or too much like, I'm not going to be able to have that, so I might as well just shut it down. And so I suppose what I'm saying is that the anorexia, I do identify as being avoidant, attached, and being a reproductive, are perhaps all stemming from the same place. This self-protective response that I have developed, which is just deny my needs, become completely self-sufficient, and just sort of like get through the painful parts of life. So yes, like I said, that feels quite vulnerable, but I wanted to talk about this with you because I think it was something that really became clear for me whilst reading Mother Hunger. I was able to put those puzzle pieces together for myself in a way that I hadn't before. And for me, the benefit of doing that kind of work, that sort of self-reflection, is that when I know this about myself, I can notice when that self-protective instinct to shut other people out, to deny my needs, and to be uber self-sufficient is actually dysfunctional. And I can gently kind of remind myself that it's okay to have these needs. It's okay to reach out to others. It's okay to depend on others and gently sort of, yeah, invite some more support, nurturing, et cetera, into my life. So sorry, that was a bit of a monologue, but I'd love to hear your reflections on what I shared.
I think you've got a TED talk there. that was gorgeous. That was so coherent and beautifully thought out. So I don't know that I can really add to it. I could validate in some ways two things that you said that I touched on in the Mother Hunger book. And that way, if someone listening wants to know which chapter in the book could they just go straight to, just this is all they're really interested in, it would be chapter 4, Surrogate Comfort. And this is where I talk about food as our surrogate mother. Because one of the very first ways we experience love is how we're fed. And generally that's happening with our mother. So in that relationship to food, to her, and to our own appetite are the lessons of love. So what I talk about in the book is that when a woman will finally open up to me about her struggles with food, and every woman I've worked with has struggles with food on whatever degree, that's the story of love right there. So you have really hit the core. And in your situation, and I think many situation for adult daughters, is when that love is not feeling good, that early love is not feeling good, we shut down the need for it. Because it's a lot easier to be needless, wantless, invulnerable than it is to have a need that's not going to get met. When we have a need that's not going to get met, whether that's for please feed me, please hold me, please touch me, please come be, if it's not going to get met, it's too painful. So we just shut it down. Mm-hmm. We don't feel it. Mm-hmm. And that is the foundation for anorexia.
Right.
Yes.
There's a quote.
Anorexia, though, I want to just piggyback on something else you said about the relationship you're in. You said it might have been a way for me to escape. And I want to validate that too. Because anorexia is a little body in a fight and flight response. Something is so unsafe that I have to get out of here. But as little girls, we can't go. We're too little. You did find a way out when you were 16, but you landed right into another situation that wasn't feeling good. So you found a way to stay, but be gone. And anorexia was that portal. Very resourceful of you.
I'm pausing us here to remind you that what you're listening to is one of hundreds of research interviews that I conducted for my new book, Women Without Kids, The Revolutionary Rise of an Unsung Sisterhood. The book is out in early 2023, and if you pre-order now, you can also get a free book club guide and an invite to an online launch event hosted by me. Just go to www.womenwithoutkids.com and enter your order number to get on the list. Now back to the episode. Mm-hmm. Well, this is the thing. And I think when we were taught, you were saying you don't use the term eating disorders, because right. Like so many disorders, these are coping mechanisms. These are our psyche ultimately trying to find ways to keep us safe.
That's exactly right. This is the body's design. This is the body's adaptation to an environment that's not taking care of us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The quote I was going to mention, and I just, because regardless of whether this develops into full-blown anorexia, I mean, the quote is, starving is one of the most basic ways to compensate for feeling helpless.
Yes.
I'd love if you could just unpack that for me, because I think diet culture promotes, you know, thinness, obviously, and part of thinness is restricting food. And so I just think that regardless of where we fall on the kind of spectrum in terms of a relationship or maladaptive relationships to food, many people will have felt compelled to starve themselves on some level.
Right.
But this, you're saying this is one of the most basic ways to compensate for feeling helpless. I think
yes,
I know
so
what you're going to say, but go ahead.
Well, I'm not really sure yet what I'm going to say, but I do think I want to differentiate between diet culture and people that experiment with temporary periods of starvation and what we're talking about here. What we are talking about here is a bodily response to something that is profoundly dangerous. Mm-hmm. And when we're not being fed, when we're hungry, and we're too little to feed ourselves, the body registers a threat. It just does. And it starts to shut down the need, the hunger. But what I've also seen with extreme forms of what we might call medical anorexia is these daughters have grown up with cruel, invasive mothers who were sadistic and abusive. When you have an abusive mother, and this is your first attachment figure, so it's not like... it's not like she was even trying to be kind. She was unkind and abusive. That almost always leads to a profound medical diagnosis of either dissociative identity disorder, anorexia, and definitely requires an addictive substance to medicate that pain.
Right, right.
That's what I call third-degree mother hunger. So when I had to create a separate category for this, Ruby, because many of us are on the mother hunger spectrum somewhere, but we might have gotten a little bit of protection or a little bit of guidance. But when our mother is a threat, she's our first intimate partner. That's intimate partner violence. Mm. That's domestic abuse. And when that happens so young and our relational template is forming, we're going to have what looks like some pretty disordered behavior.
And so starvation is a way of shutting down the need to connect with that person.
Yes, it's just too dangerous. And that's a way to feel safer and a way to feel like I'm out of here, even though I have to stay here. So being anorexic very young is also a form of staying dissociated, because you're not really in your body. You're not in your life. You're always in deprivation, thinking about how to avoid eating. That's the predominant thought. So you're not feeling what's going on around you. It's very protective.
Mm-hmm. I just want to reiterate as well, again, that wasn't my experience with my mother. She wasn't vindictive or cruel, and neither was my stepmother. And I think that the sharp descent into my anorexic phase, as I think about it, was much more largely due to this relationship that I got into at age 16, even though both the relationship and the anorexia were both forms of escape, I think, from what just felt like a very confusing family situation.
Very
there was a lot
confusing.
Of confusion. I mean, I've only really put the puzzle pieces again together around my parents' separation, my stepmother scenario, much, much later in life, as we tend to, you know, only when we've got enough distance from it, can we really sort of see what was happening, you know? I'd love if you could speak, because so many people experience bulimia. And since we are on this subject, I think anyone who's listening, who's experienced more of that sort of relationship with food, I'd love to hear your thoughts on how that relates to mother hunger.
Sure. And to circle back around to how lovely you made the distinction that your mother wasn't the cruel mother, and yet you still battled with some anorexia. I think third degree mother hunger and the kind of anorexia that really could put you in the hospital, let's say. And I don't know, did yours ever do? Okay. So yours wasn't as extreme. Jeanette McCurdy's story would be a great example of understanding mother hunger that's third degree and her subsequent anorexia. Because she is outward with her story, I feel like it's okay to bring it up.
So for people who are listening, Jeanette McCurdy wrote the book, I'm Glad My Mom Died.
Exactly.
I mean, sort of says it all.
It says it all.
The fact again that that has been such a huge international instant bestseller tells me again that many people can relate to elements of her story, even though maybe her story is more extreme than most.
Even though we don't really like to think a mother could be cruel. We just don't like to think it, even though we've seen it in Hollywood with Judy Garland's story or Billie Holiday's story or even Tonya Harding's story. We've seen cruel mothering. We still think it's random. It really doesn't happen very often. We cannot really tolerate seeing this. I think it scares the little child inside of all of us who depends on her for survival. But back to what you're saying about bulimia. Yes, again, I look at eating patterns to tell me a story. So when I'm talking to someone and their eating pattern is based more in deprivation, restriction, anorexic tendencies, that's telling me one story about just, it's easier to just shut it all down. When I'm working with someone who's on the bulimic spectrum, let's say, what I'm learning is that there are moments of, I gotta have it. This is gonna be so good. And then the minute I have it, I feel polluted and I gotta get it out of me. I gotta throw it up. So that tells me a lot about what love might have felt like. We need it. We got some of it. And then it felt so bad in our body, the way we were being handled, touched, fed, that we learned to throw it right back up. And I've seen women do this with relationships, kind of binge purge, go through cycles of a lot of dating or a lot of sex. And then it starts to feel so gross that then they go through periods of no dating, no sex at all. So there's, it mimics in romantic behavior as well as food behavior, that whole bulimic binge purge. Mm. Give it to me. Got to get it out. Mm.
Yeah, that makes sense. Absolutely makes sense. And I'm sure anyone who's experienced that will be able to relate to that almost on a visceral level. One thing I just want to recap before we move on to the last thing I want to speak to you about. The way you describe food, the way we are fed, the way we are nourished literally by our mother as infants is the first experience we have of love.
Yes.
it made so clear to me the connection between food and love and why people talk about eating their feelings. And mm-hmm. because it's actually a chemical reaction that's happening, right? Can you just
very much
just to kind of just for people to sort of reflect on everything we've shared about this, to help join the dots there, because it's so clear the way you describe it is so clear.
Well, I love that you just threw in eating our feelings. I haven't heard that in a while, and that's so perfect for this conversation. And I almost have a visual with that of I'm having this feeling. Nobody around me is going to understand it. Nobody around me is going to feel it with me. It's going to leave me alone if people know I feel this sad or this angry or this hurt. So rather than share it, I'm going to eat it. I'm going to swallow it. It's going to go deep into my body where I'll keep it safe. Mm. And those feelings will stay there until we're with someone who can feel those feelings with us. That's when they start to bubble back up. They start to thaw. That's why I call the frozen grief starts to thaw when we're finally in the presence of someone who can hold these feelings with us. They're too much when we're little and we're alone. And the people around us can't feel their feelings, so they certainly can't feel ours. So I love that you brought that up in the discussion of food and how we will sooner swallow our feelings than threaten the connection with our caregiver. We want our caregiver close. We want our caregiver to like us. We want our caregiver to keep us alive. If there's something about who we are, or what we feel, or what we're saying that threatens that, we may just swallow it.
Right. I didn't even ask for it, but you've just given a fantastic explanation of the term eating our feelings, which I think people hear a lot, but we don't really think about what it means necessarily. You just made it so clear. Yeah.
I'm so glad you brought it up because no one has brought this up before. This is a great discussion.
In terms of when we're literally nursing from our mother's breast, however,
yeah,
mother's milk, breast milk, contains chemical compounds that, I don't know, I think it's activate oxytocin in both the mother and infant, which is the love hormone, and creates the feeling of being in love.
Yes.
Hopefully people who are listening will have experienced that feeling of being in love with someone or something. And oxytocin is present, and this is what's being exchanged between mother and infant in the experience of nursing. And so on a very literal, biological level, this experience of feeding, being fed, being nourished is our first physical experience of love.
It definitely is. And prolactin is in there too. And I think where I get where I'm sad that medical professionals aren't more aware of this, that prolactin and oxytocin, in order for them to come in full force, and we almost need that to fall in love. We need this to rush into our body. Prolactin and oxytocin both rely on proximity. Baby and mommy have to stay close, skin contact, smell. Baby smells the breast, smells the milk. That starts to bring the milk down. So a lot of women that are not able to have enough time, or they're not aware of this and they're trying to pump their milk, may struggle because without the baby in arm, nature is not getting that signal, bring on the prolactin, bring on the oxytocin. It's just a machine. So I personally, as a young mother, I could never let down to the machine. I tried to pump. I couldn't do it. But the minute my baby would latch on, I made tons of milk as long as I just sat still and gave it time. Just like falling in love with an adult, we have to sit still. We have to give it time for bonding to happen. It's the same thing with a baby. Mother Nature is designed to make it happen pretty quickly, but our world separates mothers and babies so much, keeps us moving so quickly, that there's almost no time for Mother Nature to do what she's trying to do.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Which actually kind of brings us into the next, or the last piece I want to discuss with you. And to preface this, I want to just off the back of that say that this is not to shame anybody who's experienced difficulties breastfeeding or who has felt challenges around that or has not been able to quote unquote do it properly. Again, as you're pointing out, this is our culture is not built to support mothers in their nursing.
It's not. In fact, it gets in the way. So it breaks my heart when women say, I didn't have milk and I couldn't do it. And I'm thinking, there are few situations where maybe biology had been hijacked, but a lot of times is that the structures around this mother were threatening. They were unhelpful. They were not bountiful. Mothers need as much nurturing and protection in those early days as her newborn, and most don't have it. So the milk gets somewhat stuck when the body's afraid or not supported. So I think sometimes when women say, I couldn't make milk, I want to ask her, I want to hold her and say, who was holding you? Who was feeding you? Who was keeping your environment soft and sweet and warm and slowing you down so that you had a chance?
It's not so obvious.
It's not obvious. And it's a much bigger systemic issue than just one mom and one baby.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to sort of jump in with there is like, I was raised in the UK and throughout my career, I actually had a real boon in my journalism career, filling in on different magazines and papers when people would go off on maternity leave. Because I was at the age when everyone was having kids and they're kind of like early to mid 30s and I wasn't having kids. And all these people would go off on their 6 month maternity leave packages and I would get to be in their place and kind of get my feet under the table at all these different publications. So it kind of worked out quite well for me. And then when I moved to the US, again, it's not something I've personally experienced, but just the shocking, truly shocking lack of parental leave that's available to people and the expectation that is placed on people to return to their workplace within weeks of giving birth just seems absolutely inhumane and inseparable from high rates of depression, anxiety amongst mothers and children. It just all seems like it's part of the same problem. And I suppose what I want to talk about here is, you know, there's a chapter in the book where I talk about one reason there are more women without kids is that more women, and I'll put this in air quotes, are choosing career over motherhood. On the one hand, it's not a choice for a lot of women, for most women now. Earning an income is a necessity, you know, even if you're partnered, one income is not enough to support a family anymore. So whether we're choosing our career over motherhood, it's often a very, very difficult choice that doesn't feel like a choice for people.
Exactly.
The other factor is, what will my experience of mothering be in this career or this work environment? Whether I'm, you know, whether I'm in at a higher profile career that comes with some benefits and a decent salary and opportunities for promotion, or whether I'm a waged worker where actually I'm really making myself very vulnerable if I'm unable to work, keep the same workload. So yeah, there's, like I said, a whole chapter on this, and I think that women who are accused of being heartless when they are choosing career over motherhood, it's nowhere near as simple as that. And actually, oftentimes, although painful for many people, the absolute right choice when it comes to how being working full-time is going to impact our capacity to mother and therefore the mother hunger that may result from that, you know?
That will result.
I will just say that.
And I think what I'd like to say in response to this beautiful piece that you just stated so eloquently is sometimes the choice not to have a child is the most loving choice. It's not just only correct, it's loving, because it's admitting, given my work situation, given how I got to survive, I'm going to love this child better by not bringing this child into this situation. And it's a heartbreaking choice, but women do it. And I think this is partly why I wanted to write this book, because not to make it harder on women, not to make women feel less than if they couldn't. No, this is not a parenting manual. It is a book that says, this is what a little one requires. And if you think that that's possible while also having this dynamic career, you're buying the lie that our culture gives us that you can have it all. It's a lie. It's a terrible lie. And it sets women up for horrible feelings of shame, insecurity. And I just am so sad of seeing it. Mm-hmm. So it's my part of saying, no, this is not possible for women to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't expect puppies or cattle or horses to do it. If we take their babies away from them prematurely, we know those babies are going to have problems. And that's only a 6-week gestation or whatever that they're nursing before they wean. But still, if any of us have had an example of fostering or rescuing a kitten or a puppy or a horse that was prematurely taken from its mother, we can't quite substitute for what was lost.
Yeah. Again, which again is not to shame any mother who is working and juggling the both. It's to acknowledge if this feels difficult and if you feel like something is missing, it's not your fault. It's the system is not designed to support mothering.
And
I think that's a big reality. Biology. The system is not designed to support biology.
Exactly.
And I think that that's the big conversation that's on the brink of being had and is beginning to be had, which I'm really grateful for. It just makes me, the feelings that come up when I think about this subject are largely anger. That this is being allowed to go on, and that women, yet again, are the ones who are being made to feel guilty for not being able to do it all, you know, learn how it all. Yeah.
It's like Jess Groh, who wrote early in COVID that women are the shock absorbers for COVID because we were carrying everyone's fear and grief during COVID while we're mothering and working and dealing with our own. We are the shock absorbers for everything that's just not quite lining up.
Right.
And COVID really brought that out.
Absolutely.
But I think conversations like this are pointing in that direction. It's cruel to women.
Absolutely. And it makes me think, and this is like my sort of theoretical linguist brain goes off somewhere, but how the root of the word mother is matra, which means matter, which means material, the material world. Like our mother is our first experience of literally a physical body and being in the material world. And it makes me think about how our materialistic culture has almost become a substitute and a way that we gratify or attempt to satisfy our mother hunger, and how actually this culture of materialism, consuming things, buying things, and earning the money that we need in order to do that has become a sort of a substitute, yet another maladaption to this mother hunger that we feel, which will never actually be truly satisfied by. We can buy all the things in the world and have all the material goods in the world, but which is why, you know, they say money can't buy love, right?
Right. It can feel good in a moment.
Yeah, in the moment, so long as it keeps coming.
But it is a surrogate mother.
Yeah.
So absolutely. I love that connection with the root word. Beautiful.
Just to finish, if you have a couple more minutes, is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I sort of touched on how I've begun to heal my own mother hunger, which has been around cultivating awareness of the roots of this, noticing how it's showing up for me, the tendencies that it creates in me, and sort of consciously choosing to take different actions. How are some sort of very simplistic ways, and again, I'll encourage people to engage more deeply with your work and certainly to read your book, but some ways that people can begin to think about healing their mother hunger?
I will say, Ruby, that you are in the PhD of healing. I mean, your ability to both identify where the pain may be coming from and then make sense of it lets your body then know how to go remother, replace what was lost. So it's a pleasure listening to how dynamic your brain and body work together. They're in good relationship. But I think for lots of women first coming to this concept, we're almost like strangers on the block. We don't yet perhaps have that integration between our mind's insight and our body's needs. We've gotten so good at being separate from our own self. So a lot of the work of Mother Hunger is becoming more integrated, starting to know who we really are. Who was our original child? What was she like? Was she generally pretty happy? Was she innocent? Was she sweet? Was she afraid? To get to know the little buried child who has been searching for surrogate mothers, dabbling with ways to feel okay in the world, and pretty much a stranger to us. She's got to learn to trust us. And so reading the Mother Hunger book can be a good start to putting names to what you lost. Did you lose nurturing? Or maybe you had that. Did you lose some protection? How about some guidance? Did you have that? And when we can start to see what we may not have had, we can start to check in with what's the best way to replace that now. And I realize that's a pretty simple answer for someone like you, who you've been doing this for a while, but a lot of people haven't even started.
I think it's a simple and profound answer, because so often we're unconsciously reaching things to replace that, which are unhealthy, and recognizing, and this is obviously dovetails with my work with Sober Curious, but recognizing what we actually need when we're reaching for a drink or, you know, another online purchase or another relationship.
Another pint of ice cream.
Another pint of ice cream. What do I really need in this moment? And what are some other ways that I could either give that to myself or reach out and ask for that thing, which is the scariest thing of all.
It is scary, because usually when we're reaching for that, let's see, specifically around what I've seen in my practice around food, ice cream, alcohol, when we're reaching for that, we're generally in a very young place. Mm. We're little, we're tiny. And it's that child that thinks she knows how to mother us now. And we have to reteach her. We have to be her mother now.
Mm-mm. Kelly, thank you so much for your work, for this term, Mother Hunger, and for coming on to share and talk to me about all of this today. I deeply appreciate your work.
And I am so excited about the book that you're birthing into the world and the level to which we could have this conversation together. Truly an honor, Ruby. Thank you.
That was my conversation with Kelly McDaniel. As you can tell, discovering her work has been transformational for me. And if you identify with any of the subjects we raised here, then I highly recommend getting a copy of her book. And don't forget, Women Without Kids, The Revolutionary Rise of an Unsung Sisterhood is out March 28th. If you're listening to this in time to pre-order, you can also enter your details at www.womenwithoutkids.com to receive a free reading group guide to the book. This podcast features original music and is edited by Aloe Audio. That's Aloe Audio.com.